Call the House Committee on Judiciary to Order, September 22nd, 2011. In our agenda here, we're talking about introduction of committee members. I think everybody knows everybody. That'll save a few minutes. Representative Schaufler does have, do you have suit pants on?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you have suit pants on?
Absolutely.
Long pants.
Got my dress shoes on, too.
Working pants.
Mr. Taylor, do you want to introduce your staff, all your care staff, real quick?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, I'm Bill Taylor. I'm counsel of both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. This is the office manager, Noel DeJong, just back here. And a personal note, she just sold her house today, and she's anxiously waiting for this weekend to check out new ones.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Congratulations.
Next order of business will be the adoption of committee rules. You want to talk to us about the rules or any changes?
Members of the committee, they're basically the same as before. Majority of the members are required to quorum. It requires a majority of the members to take any action. It takes one person, one member, to receive testimony. And the one change will be that you will have five bills to introduce, and you will have to agree and vote on the introduction of those bills probably in November. We have tied that in. We have several work groups that you know about, and those work groups will be ongoing, and you'll be getting reports from those work groups in November. And if any proposed legislation comes from them, the House members will have to vote on those particular issues so that we can get a legislative draft for February, which means we'll have to have a quorum, and we'll have to have a majority of the members of that quorum voting to move that legislation into draft form and introduction. Then later, you'll come back in January and vote to determine whether to introduce it into session.
Do you want to make a motion on adopting that?
Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt the committee rules.
Co-Chair Barker has moved that we adopt the committee rules. Are there any discussions on that issue, that motion? Any objections? If not, they're adopted. And we will open a informational meeting on House Bill 3241.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I believe I have a quorum now that I'd like to go ahead and get us started, if I could. I'll go ahead and open up the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We, too, are meeting for our first time, and we have to do the same as the House, and that is organizational meeting. So I'll open up the organizational meeting for the purpose of, at this point, adoption of the rules.
Mr. Chair? You're quite simple. I move adoption of the proposed committee rules dated 9/21/2011.
All right. Senator Cruz moves for the adoption of the proposed committee rules dated 9/21/2011.
Is there any objection?
So ordered. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will also open up our informational meeting at this time for the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Okay, we have invited testimony on 3241. Would Dave Fedaki and Craig Shamoff come up, please?
Chair, I would suggest Representative Sheehan come first. He has Professor Hoffman, who's on the way, but he is the sponsor of the bill. We did not have, weren't sure whether Hoffman was coming, so we did not list him as invited testimony, which you may want to hear, if possible, from the proponents of the bill first.
Okay, you guys come on up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairs, Vice Chairs, members all. My name is Patrick Sheehan. I'm State Representative for House District 51. And we have introduced a House bill that you guys know very well. It's the one that got just three no votes on the House floor. It's the Funeral Civility Act. And this is the bill that protects grieving families. I'm going to be really brief in my introduction here, because we've got Jim Huffman, who's a constitutional professor, coming in to talk about this. This committee, the Senate committee, had some concerns about this after it passed out of the House, that this might result in some legal fees that the state would have to pay to protesters that come in and challenge this law. The result of that concern has been that we have redrafted this thing about a million times, and I think we finally have a mechanism here that I'm hoping will make everyone happy. The premise is really simple. Entrance and exit from a funeral service procession are parts of the ceremony, widely accepted parts of the ceremony. Funerals are typically private functions, and private spaces are often rented public spaces are often rented for private events where guests are invited exclusively to use the space. So if somebody can use the rotunda of the Capitol, that's reservable four times out of the year, or somebody can reserve a shelter at a state park for a picnic, there really shouldn't be any reason why a reasonable amount of public space outside a cemetery or memorial hall should be reservable for the purpose of funeral ceremonies. Conditions and exclusions may exist in rental contracts, which allow some types of, like, a maintenance person to walk through the area, just like this mechanism here, which I'll have my assistant John pass out if he can. This just latest draft of what we're working with, which was updated about 20 minutes ago. So there could be exclusions. We have an exclusion in here saying a vehicle passing through or somebody trying to access private property may go through the area that's being reserved. Otherwise, it's for invited guests only. So this does not deny anyone the ability to assemble or to express. It follows a well-established practice of allowing public space to be rented for a private event with a specific purpose. So I'll let you guys read the draft of the mechanism we're looking at now, and hopefully you'll like what you see.
State Representative Jim Widener, Yamhill County, Washington, and now into Washington County. I was one of the first, well, Patrick and I, Representative Sheehan and I, both had sponsored this bill the first time. We had copied Arizona law in the beginning, but after I got rolling with it, we had a lot of signatures. We both chief co-sponsored this legislation. We worked with a lot of members, a lot of attorneys who are sitting on this committee here to draft the legislation that actually passed the House almost unanimously. If we could have just won three more people, which I thought they probably would have jumped on board, but now we are working on something that will probably have everybody to leave the House unanimously, and we're hoping to get input from the Senate to make sure that they're on board with it, because I think it probably would have went through the Senate with probably 28 aye votes on it with what we had before, but we want to make sure we get it right so we can get it out of the Senate committee and get it to the Senate floor for passage. And that's why Representative Sheehan has invited Professor Huffman to come in to speak today, who is a constitutional law professor and understands this very well and has dealt with a lot of cases. With that, I will hand it over to Mr. Huffman.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your allowing me to testify and say a few words about this proposed legislation.
Can you identify yourself, please?
Yes. Jim Huffman. I'm a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School.
Thank you.
Actually, Professor Emeritus. It's my belief that most Oregonians agree with the objective of HB 3241A to respect the right to privacy of those who gather to memorialize and mourn the death of another human being. I also believe that most Oregonians agree that freedom of expression is a fundamental right guaranteed by all, to all. Finally, I believe that most Oregonians agree that the state of Oregon and the state legislature has an affirmative responsibility to respect and protect the rights of all individuals. Assuming I'm correct in those beliefs, the legislative challenge is to fulfill its responsibility to protect the constitutional rights of individuals while avoiding circumstances in which the exercise of one right...
Mr. Hoffman,
yes, sir.
You take the microphone and move it away from you. We're getting feedback.
Okay. Is that better?
That's great. Thank you.
If I'm correct in these assumptions, the legislative challenge, I think, is to fulfill its responsibility to protect the constitutional rights of individuals while avoiding circumstances in which the exercise of one right interferes with the exercise of another right. That is the broad challenge faced, I think, by the authors and proponents of this piece of legislation. Recognizing that the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and Section 8, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution place high hurdles in the path of laws affecting free expression, It's my opinion that HB 3241 is on the right track and can be finalized in a form that will satisfy the requirements of both the United States and Oregon constitutions while providing important protection of the privacy rights of mourners. Both constitutions allow for time, place, and manner restrictions on speech and expressive activity. Although Oregon case law seems to allow for a narrower range of such restrictions, the requirement under either constitution is that the restrictions be for a legitimate public purpose, unrelated to the content of the restricted expression, be narrowly tailored, and allow for other effective opportunities to communicate the information or opinion. The purpose of HB 3231 is clearly legitimate and unrelated to the content of any offending expression. The purpose is to protect the privacy rights of those who gather to memorialize and or to mourn the death of another. No human activity is more dependent on quiet observance in a solemn and respectful environment than is a funeral or memorial service. Such quiet observance is disrupted by expressive activities without regard to the content of the expression. Expression conveying any information or opinion can be equally disruptive of the mourner's privacy rights. Often the time, place, or manner exception to the constitutional prohibition applies where the public good of free expression conflicts with other public goods like traffic management or preserving the solitude of a residential neighborhood. But the time, place, or manner exception on free expression also reflects the recognition that there is not an impenetrable barrier between private and public space. Many private activities take place in part or in whole in public space. As volumes of criminal procedure case law testify, the fact that private activity sometimes occurs in public space makes those activities no less private. In my opinion, and in light of the United States and Oregon case law, I think HB 3241 reflects a good faith, successful effort to achieve the difficult balance required of the state in meeting its responsibility to protect both the right of free expression and the right to privately mourn and memorialize the dead. It is in the nature of constitutional law in general, and free expression law in particular, that there will always be uncertainty as to the constitutionality of proposed regulations like HB 3241. If a particular regulation or statute is challenged as unconstitutional, we cannot know for certain until a court of last resort rules. We must therefore predict what the courts will do based on what they have done in the past. In my mind, that reality means that you as legislators must make a good faith effort to predict whether or not legislation will be deemed constitutional, but you must also do what you believe is necessary to meet your responsibility to protect the rights of all of the citizens you represent. The fly in the ointment is that you and I know this law, if enacted, and in whatever form it's enacted, will be challenged in the courts. This will result in cost to the state defending the law and further cost to the state in the form of lawyer's fees if it is found to be unconstitutional. While I don't question your responsibility to consider the cost of every action you take, I believe the possibility of unknowable future costs should not stand in the way of meeting your core responsibility of protecting the rights of all the citizens you represent. Thank you.
Committee members, do you have any questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Professor, just so I'm clear, is your testimony directed to the bill that passed the House earlier this year, or is it directed to what the new language I see that has been distributed?
It's directed to the new language that's been distributed, yes.
We changed the new language a little bit. Just
the last I saw was in
the way of it here.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But not substantially.
Okay.
Okay, any further questions? Was there one?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Dean Huffman, good to see you. Thank you for coming down.
Ron, nice to see you.
I'm wondering, on the language that I'm looking at, it seems to me like this is content neutral and that we would get the lower standard of review. Is that your assessment as well?
Absolutely. I think that's the key to being able to implement a time, place, and manner regulation is that it be content neutral. And I believe this language is.
Thank you.
Anybody further have any questions, comments? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
let's have Mr. Shamoff and Mr. Fedanke come up now, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and Chair Przanski. For the record, I'm David Fedanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, testifying today in opposition to efforts to pass legislation intended to limit public demonstrations on public property related to funerals. We have submitted our written testimony to you. I will not read that. Instead, and I've asked Mr. Chamoff to be here today as in his capacity as a volunteer cooperating attorney for the ACLU of Oregon to address the constitutional issues. I want to just say a few words about this issue in general. I think some of you have heard similar sentiments from our former legislative director, Andrea Meyer, who will soon be working for the National ACLU in New York. We find the statements and demonstrations that have been made by members and supporters of the Westboro Baptist Church related to the service of veterans and in particular to those who have fallen to be reprehensible. We are here today just more than 10 years after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. And yet, many of us in this country have not had the same sense or been called on to make sacrifices in fighting that war. Certainly nothing that can compare to the sacrifices that have been made by our men and women in uniform in military service. And of course, those who have paid the price with their lives and their families have suffered far more than those of us who have been civilians over this past decade. The ACLU's opposition to this legislation is taken not out of disrespect to those service members and those who have fallen and their families, but out of respect for them and for the Constitution and the freedom they have fought for. And that is a difficult thing, I know, for all of you. You have taken oaths to uphold the Oregon and United States constitutions as public officials. And nothing is more difficult than to be in your situation and have to choose between following that oath and taking action in on behalf of those whom we all have tremendous respect and admiration for. But in this case, we hope you will understand not just the constitutional problems with this legislation, but keep in mind what has occurred in other states who have followed a path similar to what the proponents and introducers of this legislation would have you do. Because, in fact, a large part of how the Westboro Baptist Church chooses where it will go and when it will go has to do with where laws have been passed that are designed to make it difficult, if not impossible, for them to express their reprehensible views. So I would submit to you that if you want to keep the Westboro Baptist Church out of Oregon, you should not pass this legislation or anything similar to it. Because if you do, it is an engraved invitation to the Westboro Baptist Church and their supporters to come to Oregon and to pursue litigation against this legislation or anything similar to it. With that, I'll turn things over to Mr. Chamoff, and thank you very much for asking for our input.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members, thank you very much for the invitation to appear in front of you. It's a pleasure to be back, and not just because Representative Schaffler is wearing his big boy pants. The measure that Representative Sheehan has passed out is not one that we've...
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, appearing on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon Foundation. The proposal that Representative Sheehan has passed out is not one that we've had an opportunity to study. The legal memorandum that we prepared for Mr. Fedanke addresses the version of the bill that passed from the House of Representatives, so the specific legal analysis that you'll find in that is not in and of itself applicable to the new proposal. But there is an overarching legal concept that I hope you will keep in mind and that we will bring back to you with a more detailed analysis when the appropriate time comes, and that is, under Oregon's Constitution, you may not target a particular activity for special treatment when it comes to speech. We have the most restrictive, in terms of not allowing the government to make laws, free speech provision in the entire country and probably the entire world. It's not an accident. The people who founded this state wanted to prevent you from passing laws like this. Anytime any group of people gets together to form a government, they put into that organic document protections for the people who were there at the time, particularly the people who were in power. You can see that in states where coal mining is important, you will find special protections for coal mining companies. In the United States Constitution, you found special protections for large agricultural interests who made their wages through the use of forced labor. In Oregon, most of the folks who came here were the dispossessed. They were the ones who did not like government. If they had any relationship with government, it was largely because government came to kick them off their land because they'd been foreclosed on, or to fine them because their cattle had wandered off and trampled somebody else's land. There weren't any rich people here. We didn't have coal companies. We didn't have big railroads. We didn't have the kind of magnates that they had in other parts of the country. The people who were the most powerful at the time Oregon became a state were newspaper people. If you have an opportunity, I recommend visiting the home that's now a museum, Bush House, here in Salem, in the lovely park that bears the name of Asa Hell Bush, who was at the time of Oregon statehood the most important, powerful person around. Never held public office, but he was the owner, publisher, and editor of the Journal, the Oregon Statesman. And from that position, he made and broke political careers. And from that position, he made sure that in Oregon's Constitution, there was a provision that said you may not pass a law that restricts speech on any subject whatever. And the way our courts have interpreted that provision, you can't pick and choose those activities that you want to protect from protests, no matter how deserving they be of protection from protest. The same principle that prevents you from putting up a don't disturb area outside this building so you can't hear your constituents clamoring for different decisions than you're likely to make is the same analysis that prevents you from putting up those kind of barriers around a funeral or any other kind of activity. So we'll be back, I'm confident. Representative Sheehan's proposal take more concrete form in the 2012 session with, I hope, a more detailed analysis for you based on these principles. But to echo what Mr. Fedanke has said, neither of us likes taking a position that we know, frankly, you'd rather not hear. We understand why people like this legislation, and if our own personal feelings were involved in this, you know, I might be sitting with my good colleague from Clackamas County on this issue. but our role is to bring to you the best advice that we can about how to make decisions based on the rules that were provided to you by the people who founded this great state. And those principles do not include passing legislation like this. Thank you.
Committee members, any comments, questions? Ms. Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fedenke, so help me understand. I followed this issue somewhat in the newspapers. So did I understand you to say that the only time that this group comes to a state to protest a funeral, make their whatever, onerous statements they make, is when a state is trying to stop them?
Mr. Chair, Ms. and co-chairs, and Representative Tomei, I didn't mean to imply that's the only time they go to states, but they definitely target states where legislation has been approved. I recently heard from a colleague down in San Francisco who had been contacted by a member of the Phelps family because a local ordinance was under consideration there. In fact, the Westboro Baptist Church is already making plans to go to San Francisco if that ordinance is approved. So I think there is a very definite correlation between where there are laws designed to prevent or make more difficult their activities and where they go, where they make a priority.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members of the committee, when I researched this issue on the Phelpses, Mr. Phelps is a lawyer. He has 12 kids. 10 of them are lawyers. And according to the newspaper accounts and news reports that I read, they finance a significant part of their activities through the legal fees that they get from local government and state and even individuals on this issue. There was a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court where a family of a Marine sued them for damages. They got a significant award through the jury, went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court said that it was protected speech. They could not be sued. And then through the process, the family that sued them wound up having to pay attorney's fees. So, as I said, there's several articles in the newspaper accounts of how they finance their activities through lawsuits.
Now, somebody that would have 10 children that were attorneys would be awful questionable to me to start with. Senator Pavansky.
Thank you. Mr. Fedenke, Mr. Chamoff, thank you all for being here. I am going to ask you to take the time and provide us, as you did on the previous bill, your analysis, understand the overall breadth of how our Constitution was founded, and there has been some discussion, content neutral, which seems to be a safe haven for some type of legislation, but I'm also hearing Oregon may be even more particular than what you would see permissible under another state constitution or under the federal constitution.
Chair Przanski, not being an attorney myself, I'm not bound, as Mr. Chamoff is, to make sure that he's giving you the most accurate analysis. But from a quick review of Representative Sheehan's most recent draft, it looks extremely similar in large part to Section 1 of House Bill 3241A engrossed. There are some differences, but they don't touch, I think, the largest part of Mr. Chamoff's analysis that's in the memo you received today. And there, at least under Article 1, Section 8, as I understand it, there are two issues. Under the Federal First Amendment, we tend to think of this content neutrality issue being paramount. But under the Oregon Bill of Rights, the first thing that our Supreme Court and our other courts look to is whether or not the measure is designed to prevent communication. And if it is designed to prevent communication, it is prohibited by Article 1, Section 8. And in this case, I would submit it may also be prohibited by Article 1, Section 26, which is the guarantee of the right of assembly in the Oregon Constitution. Mr. Chamoff mentioned a, cited a federal case that had to do with reserving public space where the argument was made by the city of Portland that it was a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. And in that case, the federal courts held that you could not prevent other speakers from being in that location or near that location who wanted to present a political message. So, you know, I'm fairly confident, I'm quite confident, that when Mr. Chamoff reviews this latest draft, he will come to a virtually identical conclusion.
Sorry, was it?
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chamoff, I'm a retired veterinarian, and so I certainly don't, not steeped in legal precedent, but if I were so incensed by your testimony that I chose to get up and moon you, that would be an illegal act in Oregon, I believe. And it would be, and it would also be an expression of my opinion. Not necessarily my opinion of you, but I mean, I'm just making a point here. So that law actually limits my right of free expression. Help me understand the difference between that limit of my free expression and the limit of someone's free expression who is making an equally offensive gestures or language at a funeral.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think I disagree with your premise. I think, unfortunately, you would be well within your rights to stand up and moon me.
Really?
Yes.
Senator, for the record.
Too much information.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
just to follow up, what I would assume is why Mr. Chamoff is saying this is that when you look at some of these situations on the sexual crimes, it has to be for sexual arousal, or you know, the intent of the person has to have certain other intent to carry out to be prohibited under the state law, as compared to a expression of showing your gratitude or whatever.
I've been waiting 11 years to hear someone booed in a committee room. The closest thing I've seen is Representative Schaffler take on a few people. But you had your hand up.
Yes, please. Well, we thank you, Mr. Chair. We do manage speech. I can't call my friend Mr. Chamoff up and tell him I'm going to come over and beat the crap out of him for his commenting on my fashion choices. That's against the law. Isn't that right, Counselor? I believe it is. You can't yell fire in a theater, a bunch of people pour out and get hurt. That's against that. You can't do that. One may say that's a piece, one may think that that's an expression, and it is an expression, but I think these grieving families, there's something being taken away from them. They're being harmed, and that's the intent of this, not to stop their expression. They want to stand out here in the street and make fool of themselves, these wackos. That's their business. I'm not against that. But I think there's a time and a place, once again, for everything, and I think these families are being harmed. I am concerned about us triggering these lunatics coming up here with this law, but I cannot ever see myself voting no on this. It's just something, and I don't think we should legislate out of fear of somebody doing something stupid, or forgive me, not act out of fear of someone doing something stupid. That's just my comment. But we do manage speech, Greg, and we already do have laws that do that. Now, if I'm not wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong, Counselor.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Schaffler, first, I've learned it's not a good idea to disagree with you. Second, you are correct that to a degree, Oregon governments are permitted to regulate some activities that count as expression. For example, I can't bribe you to vote a particular way.
Even yeah, right, you can't.
That's why I singled you out, sir. We do criminalize that. The point I was making about the historical context, though, is every place has a constitution that sets a line down for the protection of speech. Some allow more, some allow less. Ours is all the way out to the end. And where Representative Sheehan's proposal, based on the small time I've had to look at it, seems to fall is on the prohibited side. I can't disagree with you that there are instances in which we as a society may, even under our expansive constitution, prohibit some activities, but we do so much, much less than other places.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm fascinated by your discussion about the fact that this is imposing a time, place, and manner restriction around funerals, that in and of itself somehow changes this from a content-neutral discussion into a content-specific discussion. And let me tell you what I mean, because my limited understanding from Lewis and Clark Law School class 2000 is that the freedom of expression deals with the speaker and the rights of the speaker and whether or not what the speaker is saying is being restricted based upon its content, not upon if they're going around a funeral or around a parade or around something else. And so this logical argument that you've made that because we're dealing with funerals, ergo, it is no longer content specific is what's interesting to me. Is there any Supreme Court case, either U.S. or otherwise, that helps inform my thought process on that argument?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Wand, from one graduate of the same law school to the other. I would agree with your general principles of how the Oregon Constitution frames free speech questions. Where I think my view of the matter appears to differ from yours is that when the government is telling someone that the government may not undertake an activity in the vicinity of a specific kind of event, that conduct by the government is picking and choosing where speech can occur based upon what's happening in the location. And that's where, under the Oregon analysis, you begin to get yourself into trouble, so that this body would not have the authority to decide that there are going to be quiet zones around every government building or around every city hall or around other places where people might reasonably choose to be noisy because they want the people inside to hear them.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've gotten close to answering this question, Mr. Chamoff, we're going to be getting your analysis, but I just was wondering if kind of in a nutshell you could tell us why is Representative Sheehan wrong to analogize this to any other instance of a private citizen reserving a public space for a specified purpose, whether it be a park or a street or another public right-of-way. Clearly we can do that even in Oregon, but you're saying not in this way. So why not?
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Vice Chair, because in this instance, the law isn't just saying feel free to use a park. To analogize it would be you may reserve a park if it happens to be next to where a funeral is taking place. So the example that Representative Sheehan is using is there isn't any particular activity that you are trying to reserve to keep people away from some other activity. It is applicable generally everywhere. it would, in this sense, it would apply to all the streets, all the public areas. But because this is special permission with special penalties for being near an activity that somebody might want to be next, that's where you begin to cross the line under Article 1, Section 8.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Fedenke mentioned the Ninth Circuit case, which is Gaythright versus the City of Portland, and they gave a permit to someone to use Pioneer Square. It was, I believe, a cookout and other events like that. And someone was coming in to demonstrate. I believe he was reading the Bible. Let me read you the holding. We hold, however, that the policy of allowing permittees unfettered discretion to exclude private citizens on any or no basis is not narrowly tailored to the city's legitimate interest in protecting its permittees' rights under a Supreme Court case, a Hurley case, which basically it would be unconstitutional.
Okay.
That's the Ninth Circuit. It applies here historically, as you know, and we know from experience in the child pornography area, the Oregon Constitution grants greater rights. So that would be one way of measuring any piece of legislation against that particular Ninth Circuit case.
Well, I would assume we're going to hear more. You're going to get us an analysis.
Mr. Co-Chair, yes.
Anything else further? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
Shan, did you have something you wanted to...
I have legislative counsel here to clarify one thing that I've asked a few times.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I want him to spell his name, though. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Dave Hendricks from the City Council's office. The point that Representative Sheehan wanted me to mention is a valid point, which is that the case that's been referred to, Gaythright versus City of Portland, which is a federal case brought relating to the use of Portland's Pioneer Square. When I started looking at those cases and started looking at other cases in this area, they almost all exclusively involved the ability of a private event sponsor who had rented public space to conduct a public event. In this case, it was for a diversity promotion for diversity, and basically everybody was invited except for the one person who wanted to show up and protest the proposal that was before them, and they said, well, you're not invited, ergo, and we're not the city, we're a private entity, and so we're going to kick you out. Well, Pioneer Square is, you know, the classic example of a really pure public forum. It's people are down there having their say all the time if you've been down there. And it's one thing to look at that sort of scenario where someone's renting it to conduct another public event. The question here is the result different if you truly have a private event that you want to conduct, even though it's on public property that would normally be a public forum? And that's the issue that I think is raised by the proposal as it now stands, simply because it is essentially saying, can you simply say, look, if someone wants to lease that space, are they subject to the same limitations that would be on the public body with respect to who they can let in and who they do not have to let in? As you all know, you know, I think most people would think if they rented the ballpark down at Bush Park for a ball game that they would not have to let anybody in, a purely private event, invitees only. The way the proposal now stands with respect to this bill is that it would be limited to essentially people who have been invited by the private entity. So that's the real issue here. I think it's not a question that's really been answered. It's been kind of alluded to in many of these cases about what the result might be if it was a purely private event. But that's the one area where it seems to me there's still some question with respect to this when you look at this proposal.
Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Hendricks, I'm trying to follow your comparison, and we have apples and tables, not even apples and oranges, I think, sometimes here.
and I've only just looked at this draft 10 minutes ago. You were talking about Pioneer Place, Pioneer Square in Portland. This language talks about a 400-foot perimeter around where the event is occurring. So I'm having a hard time making a clear analogy there. If you were to extend it to Pioneer Square in Portland, were someone having a funeral service in Pioneer Square and this legislation were in effect, it would allow them to exclude non-invited guests from an area two blocks around Pioneer Square. And in the example you talked about with a genuine political event privately sponsored in Pioneer Square, are you suggesting that that would be permissible? Or does the distance make a difference in the acceptability of the proposal?
Kutcher, Krieger, Kutcher, Barker, Representative Nolan, I don't think it does. And we have got cases in other areas. We really don't have cases that address in the Oregon Supreme Court that really help us much here.
Mm-hmm.
We can make some general statements that our Constitution has language that has been interpreted to be more protective of speech than other ones, but looking at these sort of specific issues that we're discussing here, we don't have a lot of guidance. If you look to the federal courts, they've gone a lot further in some areas than probably they'd allow us to here, but they have gone there. And some of the cases, for instance, relate to political conventions. If you rent a public hall that may be a public forum for most purposes to run a convention, that doesn't mean you have to let everybody in. And there are cases that have so held. And in fact, in Colorado, there's a case where they discuss these, I don't know if you've ever seen these, where they do these free speech zones where they tell people, well, you can protest, but you've got to do it. And in Colorado, it was like a long ways away from the hall where they, so under the federal constitution, there may be a little more leeway. But there have been cases where they have allowed people to basically say, well, you know, you're running a private, but, you know, and a lot of that had to do with safety issues as well, of course, and no two ways about that, because political conventions, you know, they need to protect the people coming and going to it. But I don't think it's the distance so much. I think it's just the fact that these are public streets. And the question is, for instance, if you wanted to do a block party there and have just the neighbors come, would you be able to say, and it's just for the people who live on the street, if you wanted to reserve the street?
Okay, we're going to be running out of time. We have three more agenda items. Mr. Taylor, I'll let you finish it up, and then I'm...
Sure. Mr. Hendricks and I have debated this issue for about 3 months, and we, particularly the analogy of the baseball park over at Bush Park, and I think he's right. I think you can reserve the ballpark to play baseball, but I don't think we're talking just the ballpark. I think we're talking about the land beyond the fence, and at least my position is that I would be very uncomfortable saying that you can lease and rent the ballpark, and then you can exclude everyone from the park. And I think that brings into question whether it's a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. So what you have here is a funeral, most likely in a church, and now you're talking about the area around that church, which is public property, traditionally places that people can travel back and forth through. You can prevent people from going in the funeral. That's your message, and the early case is clear about that. You don't have to let people into your parade that you don't want to, because it's your message, not theirs. So Dave is right. We're into a very, very uncertain area. The circuit courts, courts of appeals have split in this. The majority of the district courts have found in favor of the Phelpses. And then you have to throw into the equation the Oregon Constitution.
Okay, we're going to close the informational hearing on House Bill 341. And move on to the next subject. Senator Provansky, would you like to take that, please?
Sure, I will. Our next information meeting is going to be information that we are going to be receiving from our legislative counsel, Josh Nasby. There's been, as I think most of all, the members have received after the situation that occurred in Florida with the jury verdict that came out in the case of Marie Anthony case regarding her the murder of her daughter, Kaylee. A lot of interest as to whether or not we here in Oregon should be adopting or modifying any existing statutes or making any new laws that would require some type of reporting on the part of a parent or a legal guardian of the death or possibly the missing of a report of a child. In summarizing this, it appears that it's time for us to get as much information as we can from legislative counsel as to what the state of the law is now and what might be say issues that we would want to consider for future legislation if there's a need. And I just thought that it would be good for all of us as a committee to hear this, and then if we deem that it's something that we need to move forward on, myself and the co-chairs have talked about how the procedure we would use as with the opportunity potentially using committee bill. But at this point, I'd call on Mr. Nasby to give us the perspective as to what is the state of the law here in Oregon.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Josh Nasby, and I'm a deputy of Legislative Counsel's office. And I'm going to do exactly what the good senator just described and give you kind of a brief background of the law in this area. And so I think we divided into, the agenda has it divided into two classes. We've got requiring a parent or guardian to report the death of a child, and then we've got the requiring a parent or guardian to report a missing child. Regarding the former category, reporting deaths, we have a statutory scheme in place and have since 1973. And it was a kind of a broad piece of legislation that established the state medical examiner and district medical examiners at the county level. And the statutory scheme gives the district medical examiners, in conjunction with the district attorney, the obligation to investigate what are called deaths requiring investigation. That's defined in statute. It's 146.090, and it's a fairly broad list. It's kind of what you would think. Apparently homicidal, apparently suicidal, drug overdoses, in custody deaths, while not under the care of a physician during the period immediately previous to the death. And so there's these class of deaths that are required by law to be investigated. And in addition, the legislation, or it's been the law for 30-something years now, but the law says it makes it a Class C misdemeanor, so we're at the bottom of our criminal scale. A Class C misdemeanor for any person having knowledge of a death requiring investigation to knowingly fail to notify the district medical examiner. And so just a couple of kind of observations about the current scheme. Number one, there's no distinction in terms of a familial relationship or the age of the decedent. It's just all deaths requiring investigation, and it places that obligation on everyone to notify the district medical examiner. And the second point is to the to the extent you're interested in amending this area of the law, to kind of distinguish between familial situations and non-familial situations, I think this scheme is the place to look. Sort of a side note, but if you read the statute literally, I think you could argue that anybody reading the newspaper is required to report a death that they read in the newspaper. So while my sense is a court would construe it to mean firsthand knowledge of the death, I'm just suggesting that to the extent you're amending these statutes, you might want to clarify the knowledge the statute is referring to. But the short version is it's currently a Class C misdemeanor to fail to report any of these deaths to the medical examiner. Onto the missing children side, I think there are a number of criminal statutes that potentially could apply to the situations we're talking about. But I use that word potentially intentionally. Because as I understand what we're talking about, we've got a fact pattern with two facts. We've got missing child and failure to notify. And so I think I'm going to take just a few minutes to describe these five crimes where arguably you could shoehorn just those two facts into a conviction. But I do think, assuming we got to that stage, it would be a question of first impression for the court in terms of whether any of these statutes support a conviction based solely on those two facts. And so to give you an example of what I'm talking about, there's a crime, child neglect in the second degree. It's a Class A misdemeanor, and it's committed when a person with criminal negligence leaves a child under 10 in a place for a period of time as may be likely to endanger the health or welfare of the child. And to give you kind of a concrete example of what this statute talks about, we've got two great cases from the Court of Appeals. On the one hand, they uphold a conviction where mom leaves a one-year-old and a three-year-old alone in a busy parking lot, visible, and the windows rolled down so the children are accessible. Court says, yes, that is in fact child neglect in the second degree. The court upholds that conviction. On the other hand, we've got a fact pattern where mom falls asleep.
Josh, I'm going to get you to move that mic back a little bit because you're getting more feedback. Thank you.
On the other hand, we've got a fact pattern where mom falls asleep, four-year-old seen riding down the middle of the street on a tricycle. Passerby gets the kid home, police eventually come, arrest the mom. Mom gets convicted at the trial court. Court of Appeals says mom's conduct in falling asleep isn't criminally negligent, so they reverse that conviction. So when we're talking about child neglect in the second degree, we're talking about fact patterns that fall between those two examples. And if we think about the two facts we've got, missing child, failure to report, I think it's probably a tough sell under this statute. I think we had a third fact where police come and interview mom, and she says something to the effect of, oh, I left my kid at the mall, they'll get home eventually. I think that's clearly child neglect too. But with just those two facts, it seems like a little bit of a stretch to me. We've got similar issues with the crime of child abandonment. It's a C felony. It applies when a parent or guardian deserts a child under 15 with the intent to abandon. So in a prosecution for that, state has to prove parent deserted the child with the intent to abandon. And I'm not 100% convinced we get there with just these two facts we're talking about. Moving along, we've got the C felony of criminal non-support. And so if a parent or guardian fails to provide support for a minor under 18, it's a Class C felony. Support is defined to include shelter, food, clothing, medical attention, and education. And so I think there's an argument that a parent who fails to report their missing child violates the statute. But again, it's a little bit of a reach. We do have, this is tangentially relevant, but we do have a case where defendant commits murder by abuse, so he abuses a child, child dies, and the court upholds a conviction for criminal non-support where defendant failed to seek medical attention, presumably in the period between the abuse and the child's death. So that statute can apply in that context. And then the final two criminal statutes that I think are relevant are the criminal mistreatment statutes. There's two of them. There's a first and second degree. They are respectively a C felony and an A misdemeanor. And one point about this statute is there's a lot of overlap between that statute and these child neglect and criminal non-support statutes that we talked about. But criminal mistreatment also applies to dependent persons of any age, so think severely disabled, also applies to elderly persons over 65. And so the scope of your, to the extent you're interested in legislation in this area, something to consider is that current law applies some of these protections to dependent persons and elderly persons. So that's something to consider also, I think. Apart from the overlap, the essence of these crimes is the withholding of necessary and adequate food, physical care, or medical attention. And again, I think, you know, an aggressive prosecutor might try this with just those two facts, but it's going to be a close question, in my opinion. And so the final point just want to put on your radar is that we do have a 2008 criminal mistreatment case where the court, and I think appropriately, suggests that it's a problem, it's a constitutional problem in terms of self-incrimination to essentially criminalize failing to confess to another crime. And I think that's readily surmountable in this context, but I just thought you should be cognizant of that limit at the outset as we work through this process. And so that's all I have to present. I'm happy to answer questions. We do have a scheme on deaths. You're welcome to, you know, amend it in whatever way you see appropriate. The statutory scheme in terms of missing children is, I think, any of these crimes, it's a little bit of a stretch when all we have are these two facts, missing kid and failure to report.
All right, we're going to open up for questions. And Representative Lindsay has joined us. He has a great interest in this area. So, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for letting me sit here with you today. And Mr. Naspy, thank you. I'm not a criminal attorney. What is the consequence or what is the penalty for a Class C misdemeanor and Class C felony?
So misdemeanors are divided into three classes, A, B, and C. C is 30 days max jail time, $1,250 fine. B is 6 months, $2,500 fine. And A is 1 year maximum, $6,250 fine, $6,250. Those are the misdemeanors. So we're talking 30 days, 6 months, and a year. The felony side is a little bit more interesting. Theoretically, the maximum penalty for a Class C felony is 5 years. In practice, however, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the handy-dandy colorful chart that gets waved around occasionally, the sentencing guidelines grid. And I didn't bring that with me, I'm sorry. But the Criminal Justice Commission ranks felonies according to seriousness, and occasionally the Assembly directs them, put this crime at this level of seriousness. And then the horizontal axis deals with the offender's criminal history. And so on the one end, you've got somebody who's never been convicted of anything. And on the other, you've got, I'm going to get this wrong, it might be somebody with two or more person felonies. So we've got criminal history going this way, crime seriousness going this way. So I can't give you a precise answer to that question. Again, we can talk about directing them to place it somewhere if you go the felony route. And then it's just going to be,
lifeline.
And so just let's see if I can find a good example. Criminal non-support, I spoke about earlier. That's a class, a level three on the grid. And it's actually below the yellow area, which means the presumptive sentence is going to be probationary. There might be 30, 60, 90 days of jail, that kind of a thing. But it's not until we get up into this yellow area where we're talking about prison terms, essentially 12 months plus.
Great. Thank you. And then just two more questions.
Sure.
Is there a specific statute today that expressly says that a parent or guardian must report the death or disappearance of a child within a certain time frame?
Chairs, members of the committee, Representative Lindsay. Missing, no. The answer is no. There's nothing except for what I tried to describe earlier was shoehorning those two facts into something. So the answer to that is clearly no. Deaths, the statute I described, applies across the board. It doesn't matter, parent or child. There's an obligation to report these suspicious or deaths requiring investigation.
Okay. And then the last question is if there were a specific statute that expressly stated a parent or guardian shall report the death or disappearance of a child within a certain time frame, would that reduce or even eliminate the possibility that a jury would return not guilty verdict in that circumstance?
Chairs, members of the committee, Representative Lindsay, I think the answer to that is yes. Equally important, I think, I mean, that increases the likelihood that the conviction will stick. I mean, theoretically, even if we got a jury to buy one of these shoehorn arguments, there's a possibility it gets reversed on appeal as a matter of statutory construction. So I think a specific statute would do both of those things. It would make it easier for the jury to convict in these situations when we have limited facts, and it would increase the likelihood that that conviction would ultimately stick.
Thanks.
One caveat to that, so long as it's proven beyond a reasonable doubt each and every material element?
Absolutely, Senator. That was implied.
All right. Just for the record. All right. Other questions? Any other comments? All right. Thank you, Josh, for coming up. We'll go ahead and close the informational hearing on this topic. Co-chairs, do y'all want to start the next one? Or just... All right, we're going to go ahead and open up what is our next informational hearing. This is to review the relationship between the OIA and the counties concerning supervision of youth when they are released from OIA facilities back into the communities. Committee members, if you remember this last session, there was some discussion ongoing, and it's still somewhat being discussed as to whether this would be something that we should entertain or not. I felt, and the co-chairs, that we should bring the topic up now more for kind of informational as to where the different perspectives may be. And the one thing, I guess, in starting off, we have four or five different individuals, I believe, that are here to testify. Mr. Taylor, Did we have a order of how we need it to present for a presentation?
Four counties that are making.
Okay, so.
And Scott Taylor was one of them, with other county commissioners, who probably would want them for us.
All right.
And then we have Jurgen Lupathard and others. So.
All right, so OIA will be doing second.
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Scott, if you'll come up, and I have Roland Fay and Joe Ferguson, so I'm not sure how y'all want to proceed on that, or all four of you, that'd be great. And the one thing I guess I do want to say before we even take any testimony, this is informational hearing. This is for the purpose of us getting more information. It is not, and I understand, and I feel, based on some of the contact that has come to my office, as to, let's say, individuals feeling threatened, somewhat, and what I would hate to say is somewhat appears to be more of a turf war. What I think all of us are looking for is, what is the system we have now? Is there ways to make it better than what we currently have now, and how that might work if we were, in fact, wanting to make that change? I believe that the vast majority of us that are sitting at the dais are looking for what is in the best interest of let's say, mainstreaming the youth back into the community and making certain the community is safe and we can reduce recidivism. And at the same time, looking at the cost factors for applying those standards or elements. So, Scott, if you'd like to start.
Chair Pozanski, committee, we have talked, and so we will just walk through. Each of us will do a little piece. We'll start with Roland, and then Joe, and then Faye, and then myself. And
all right, and
for to accomplish what you just asked
for. All right, and for each of you, when you first speak, if you could identify yourself for the record so we are sure to have a voice with the name, and make sure the microphone is pointed towards you, but please don't sit on top of it or you'll get the feedback.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah, I am.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Prozanski and the co-chairs, Barker and Krieger. It's my first time doing this, so I'm a little nervous, so bear with me. My name is Roland Hoskins. I'm the Department of Youth Services Director in Lane County. I'm here with my colleagues to explore what we might think are some possible cost savings. I just have a few points. First, my big point is that down in Lane County, with the reduction of the SRS monies and the budget impacts that we have, I know that my organization will not continue to look the same. And so then, if there were ideas that I heard from my colleagues or others that said we might be able to save money for the system, then I was interested. So to me, I'm not going to turn down an opportunity to do some analysis and to work through the processes with our partners, because I think it would be not appropriate for me in my position. Just as an example, like for my department, I have about an $11 million budget, or 10, just kind of right in there. With SRS dollars going down, I could lose well over a million. I've already lost, you know, $500,000 or $600,000 I cut last year. So I just know that organization's shrinking. I know it's changing. So the bottom line, I guess, for us would be we need to continue to work with our partner agencies, and that's not just us or OIA, that's also with some of the other partners that are involved, to look for ways to keep the services going for the youth and the families. And that's why I'm here, and I think that we need to be collaborative. We can't do this work without OIA. We need their help. They have valuable information that they can share with us that's important. We don't want the other communities or counties hurt by anything that we do. So if we gain something, or any one of county gains something, but it was at the detriment to the other counties, that wouldn't be okay. The way I would look at it is, if we got good cost savings across the board, then that should be an opportunity to then reallocate and find other ways to enhance some of the services where they're lacking across the state. So I don't look at this as, I think that we have to look at it as a whole, a system place, and then try to really work out and find some ways to save some money across the state, and also provide better services or improve our service delivery to the families and the youth now. So with that, I think I just pretty much hand it off to my colleagues. And again, you know, we really need the help and support of OIA and others to be in that room and to work through the analysis. And we may find out something great. We may find out that there aren't any other ways to do it. So I'd like to explore it.
That's not the one that they take it over.
Chair Prudnowski, Co-Chair Barker, and Co-Chair Kreider on the committee. My name is Joe Ferguson. I'm the Deputy Director of Youth Services with Jackson County Community Justice. And I'm just going to give a brief framework of the current juvenile justice system at the county level. And so youth are basically arrested by police. They really have a couple of different options. One is they could bring them to a county juvenile detention facility, or what's most common is that they cite the kid, there's a report generated, and that's forwarded on to the juvenile department. Upon receiving the police reports, juvenile departments look at what the appropriate level of intervention is needed through assessment and screening. This could include referring youth to other community agencies to provide services such as mental health, child welfare, nonprofit, other counseling services, or referral to other diversion programs within the juvenile departments or outside agencies, such as theft programs, teen court, drug court, other diversion type programs. Or they could take formal court action where they actually submit the charges to the juvenile court and proceed that through the court system. Juvenile departments services include a wide range of supervision, accountability, and reformation. Services include supervision on diversion agreements where the parent and youth have agreed to certain conditions such as paying restitution, completing community service, completing maybe some drug and alcohol education or treatment in lieu of going to court. They also provide supervision of formal probation where the court has ordered the youth and at times parents certain conditions to satisfy that, and again, it could be restitution, community service, anger management, attending school, things like that as well. Also, providing coordination of individual community basic services, treatment, education, employment services, and then also placement of supervision of youth, such as in Jackson County, we have our own residential program, so the court can place those kids into that program for more intensive services and supervision. And then also some counties have their own detention facilities that are used when behavior jeopardizes public safety or the youth has continued to violate the court's order. Juvenile department services are designed to protect the public and prevent further criminal behavior and penetration into the justice system. However, there are times where kids, youth, are in need of more intensive services or secure environments based on their actions, behaviors, or noncompliance. And when those behaviors are indicated, there's a more of a need for intensive services or there's a serious risk to public safety, the juvenile court can commit those kids to the Oregon Youth Authority for placement in a state-funded residential program or a youth correctional facility. At that time of commitment, the supervision currently transfers from the county juvenile departments to the Oregon Youth Authority, and this includes both probation and parole when kids are coming back from those residential programs and the youth correction facilities when they reside in their own communities. And then while under the supervision of the Oregon Youth Authority, if kids commit new crimes, again, the police reports come back to the juvenile departments to decide what action is going to be taken. There is some cooperation between the juvenile departments and OIA, but it does fall back to the juvenile departments in terms of how those new police referrals are going to be handled. And then, again, the whole process starts over from where I began in terms of what to look at services. Even though kids are already committed to OIA, they can be committed again on new crimes or put on county probation as well.
Chair Posansky, co-chairs Barker and Krieger. My name is Faye Fagel. I'm the juvenile director for Marion County. And just if I could just for a second talk about my background. I started years ago working in a residential program. I then worked juvenile probation
at a county level, actually Marion County. I then worked for the Department of Corrections. I was a community corrections director for four counties under the old Community Corrections Act that some of you may remember. And then I worked for the Oregon Youth Authority. I was an area coordinator for Benton, Lynn, and Lane, and now a juvenile director at Marion County. So I've been in the system quite a while, and I've seen a lot of changes in the system at all the levels of the justice. I was going to call it juvenile justice, but system. So Joe has talked about the process that currently exists, and the proposal that we are interested in, specifically for Marion County, is that when Joe talked about that at the point where a youth gets committed to a state contracted residential program or gets committed to a youth correctional facility out of Marion County, what we're considering is that we would be interested in retaining that supervision. So we would continue to do the case management, and that's the proposal that we have on the table. Marion County would continue to do the case management of those juveniles rather than passing them off to the youth authority at the time that they go into those placements. We have had a conversation with Oregon Youth Authority that occurred on Monday. Oregon Youth Authority has committed to having a conversation with Marion County, which we're very interested in having, to talk about what are the specifics. At this point, what we have is a concept, but we're very interested in meeting with Oregon Youth Authority and talking through specific details about what would this look like, what are some of the pros, what are some of the cons, what are some of the issues that may arise. And as Roland talked about, you know, at this point, we're exploring this concept, and we're really talking about it in the context of everything that we've talked about around the economic situation, efficiencies, reformation, public safety, and will we at that point decide, yes, this makes a lot of sense, or there's a variation of what we're proposing that might make sense, or we might, frankly, have this whole conversation and say, you know, you're right, this doesn't make sense, this is not a better way to do the business. What I would like to say, though, specifically is that we are not proposing that all counties would need or want to do this. We recognize that there are a lot of differences in the 36 counties, and what may work for one county may not work for another county. And as Roland talked about, we're also really committed that we do not cause a reduction in resources to our other county partners in their ability to provide services to juveniles and public safety in their community. And I would add to that, as a county juvenile director who works very closely within our public safety arena with our district attorney, our sheriff's department, our law enforcement, and other folks, you know, we hear about the other issues that are created within our community around just reductions at all levels of the state, county, federal, city levels. And we're very committed to public safety across the board in our community. And so we know that there are decisions that are made that may not impact the juvenile system, but might impact my partners in adult corrections in our community, the sheriff's department. And so we're committed to really looking at how do we have resources at all levels of our public safety system to provide for our community. And then lastly, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Marion County. Marion County has a really great community leadership, and Marion County has very much, within our community leadership, taken ownership for the problems that exist in our community. And we have a very engaged business leaders, nonprofits, elected officials, the faith community, law enforcement, colleges. We have a great relationship with Corbin College and with Chemeketa, and we're really invested in creating local solutions to our community problems. And I think there is an element of ability to mobilize our community around our community issues. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Chair Prozanski and other members of the committee. For the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Thank you much for inviting us to provide you with the information concerning the concept the five counties have developed. The one county that's not with us today is Deschutes County. It is not a brand new concept, and that eight states have variations of the concept. There's also some similarities to our Community Corrections Act system in Oregon, which has been used for over 30 years. This concept would require the participation and problem solving of a wide variety of public safety stakeholders, many of whom are in the room today. But we believe as we face the economic and evidence-based driven future, these discussions of possible alternative ways of doing business are required. And that's why we started this conversation in the last session, and we're honored to be asked back to have this brief information. In Multnomah County, we manage both the 8,000 adults on probation and parole and over 900 juveniles daily. OIA program in Multnomah County showed a caseload of 106 and an OIA probation caseload of 14, so 120 cases total. This five-county concept presents what I believe to be an improvement in our ability to provide the most effective array of services for youth based on local resources and infrastructure. Multnomah County Juvenile is the largest county juvenile department in Oregon. The county budget for juvenile probation is $25 million annually. $4.6 million of that is state funding. I make that point simply to indicate that we are very invested in the juvenile justice system in Multnomah County, and we put in about 80% of the funding to manage those youth every day. The counties manage about 94% of the cases. We divert them from further penetration into the criminal justice system, as both Joe and Roland talked about. We have an infrastructure that has over, I have an infrastructure of over 176 staff, 30 of which are probation and parole officers, and 10 are mental health consultants. A regional detention center, contracts with treatment providers, both residential and outpatient. We work with schools, the local law enforcement, courts, OIA, and others in Multnomah County, all the neighborhood associations and the variety of mentors and other folks we have. We have a large number of high-risk youth on probation and are parole in our county. We have the ability to access both the juvenile resources and, for those over 18, our adult resources. We have a unit that specializes in adults and juveniles in the same family under supervision. Keep in mind, all major 11 youth come back to the adult side to be managed in Multnomah County. We have specialized in electronic monitoring, sex offender, high-risk drug, all which can use resources and cooperate as a department in trying to focus our resources and deal with issues that come up. We're currently using a lot of that in our gang work. If you have, on occasion, because of the system we talked about, we can have a person that has both a juvenile probation officer, an adult probation officer, and an OIA parole officer. The intervention into a family of those three bodies certainly adds confusion. We believe that this concept, and it was a concept, somehow it's grown into a variety of something else. It was a concept that said, should we look at, are there counties that are willing to do this and can do it and can deliver it? And if there are, would that in fact be more effective for the youth, for the families, for the community that we're already highly invested in? And what are the downsides of that? We've not been able to have that conversation as to date. We are now on the verge of having that conversation, and we expect to have such conversations in the future. That's what we would hope for in the next year. Thank you.
Questions for anyone on the panel?
Thank you very much for coming forward. Our next invited guest is Colette Peters. And Colette, I understand you're going to be on your own, or do you have other people at OIA that you want to? Okay.
No, that's correct.
It's a bodyguard. I got my cue. My cue was we had to get the PowerPoint up, so I know Anola is going to help us with that. My understanding after this, we will have Mary Botkin and Molly Rogers that will be up after this. And while we're getting this set up, the Senate has had to change its schedule. The executive appointments, which were scheduled for hearing tomorrow, have been moved into this afternoon. And so we've lost at least 30 minutes of our time for today. We were scheduled 2 to 5. And I know the Senate will need to be excused by 4:30. Our goal from the co-chairs and myself is to have all of our work completed before we have to go to the floor. So we hope to be out of here no later than, let's say, 4:20, 4:15, something like that.
Okay. All right. I think we're ready.
Thank yes, you. You may.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters. I'm director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and it's nice to see all of you again. You have asked me to appear before you today to discuss the proposal the five counties just presented to you, which would allow counties to take over the state's juvenile parole and probation functions. I always get nervous when the lights dim for fear that people will get sleepy, so I'll try to stay on track here. Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to address the idea around a turf war, because I have heard that buzz a little bit, and I want you all to be assured that for the Oregon Youth Authority, that certainly has not been the case. You all know that just 2 short years ago, I inherited an agency that many considered broken. We have done a complete system review of the agency from head to toe, looking at different ways to do business. We've engaged with our partners to really see if we can do business differently, and I'll talk a little bit about that later around the Juvenile Justice System Symposium. But I think our record really has been that we are open to new ideas. We were an agency, as many know, that came to the table and said, you can cut our close custody capacity by 20% and we will give you better outcomes. So the Oregon Youth Authority today looks very different than it did 2 years ago, even in terms of capacity. So I want you to know that I am always willing to review any proposal for its potential to improve public safety, better reform youth, and certainly to save money given these economic times. And so when Mr. Taylor approached me with this idea earlier this year, he, in our conversations, we asked that he could put it in writing so we could actually have something tangible to review, and he did. We've had multiple conversations with this about this issue, both individually and with the associations. And so after receiving his proposal, the Oregon Youth Authority analyzed the proposal in cooperation with the Governor's Office, the Department of Justice, and Risk Management. Our analysis, which you should have before you, concluded that as this proposal is presented at us to date, that it falls short in those three areas. We couldn't see where the proposal improved public safety, better reformed youth, nor could we see where it saved money. And then our attorneys let us know that they felt it added an additional legal liability and risk to the state. So, since you have our analysis before you, I thought it would be useful, and I know we're short on time, so this is not a long presentation, but I thought it would be useful to provide a quick description of how the current system works and then touch on the impacts of fragmenting the system. This chart shows a complex continuum that makes up Oregon's juvenile justice system, and I saw a couple of you chuckling, so don't worry, I'm not going to discuss it in detail. But I did want you to see that OIA is one of many partners in Oregon who work together to prevent and address juvenile crime. Oregon's juvenile justice system is deliberately created this way, designed to offer a range of options for dealing with the state's at-risk youth. What I am going to focus on today, which the previous four directors did as well, is this portion of the state's juvenile justice system, county probation, and state commitment for placements. Once a youth is adjudicated delinquent, the juvenile court has 4 dispositional options. You will see those options in the very light green boxes: county probation, formal county level sanctions, state probation, and state close custody. The court determines the most appropriate option based on the severity of the youth's offense, the community's ability to meet a youth's reformation needs, public safety, and the youth's risk and protective factors. One of the most important considerations is whether the youth can be safely supervised and served while living in the home, or whether a court-ordered commitment to state custody, either probation for out-of-home placement, or a direct commitment to a youth correctional facility is necessary. When a youth has been placed in state custody, it means the court has determined the youth can no longer be supervised safely at home and requires an out-of-home placement. Once a youth is ordered under a county's jurisdiction or placed under the state's control, there are key differences in the type of oversight and treatment afforded. Counties provide great local supervision of youth who live at home while on county probation. The youth's parents or legal custodians remain responsible for the youth's actions. When courts commit young offenders then to state custody for placement, the state assumes guardianship responsibilities as well as the associated risks and liabilities for juvenile offenders in our case, and hence our attorney's analysis that there's additional risks and liabilities afforded with a proposal like this. As this slide details, our juvenile probation and parole officers, or JPPOs as we refer to them, serve as case managers. They provide youth with that one consistent point of contact throughout their time in our custody, from the point of disposition and commitment until release. So that means from the point of state probation or close custody placement and then into parole and back into the community. Functioning as case managers, our JPPOs authorize, locate, coordinate, and monitor treatment service needs for these youthful offenders. We are also responsible, of course, like any other legal guardian would be, to provide the youth's basic needs: food, clothing, shelter, education, and medical care. So as you can see, the current juvenile justice model is very different than the adult model in that there are no legal custody considerations when supervising adults, of course. And as you can see, the role of the state's youth authority is quite different from that of its juvenile justice partner agencies. Funding for the county and state programs also reflects these philosophically different roles. Counties, as were described earlier by my colleagues, within local funding limitations, provide county general fund dollars for the majority of services and sanctions. We're fortunate in the state of Oregon. We do, as Scott Taylor mentioned, have all of our counties are very committed to juvenile justice. The state, through the Oregon Youth Authority and other agencies, we provide assistance to local governments for juvenile crime prevention, intervention, and diversion services to divert youth from state custody. The Youth Authority is funded through a combination of the state general fund, other funds, and federal funds, as you are aware. But first, I will highlight the other funds because they include child support collections. As I mentioned earlier, the state has legal custody and, as a custodial parent, is entitled to receive support payments from the non-custodial parent. Another important fund to note is the, particularly related to this conversation, that a portion of state probation and parole officers' salary is paid for with federal funds under the Federal Targeted Case Management Program, or TCM. In order for us to claim TCM funding, our staff are trained and authorized as TCM providers. Additionally, the Youth Authority purchases services from our statewide programs, which I'll talk about here in more detail, and those are Medicaid-funded. Federal funding picks up approximately 40% of the services that are provided in those residential programs. The funding sources I just described pay for a variety of resources, and I'll just highlight a few. At the county level, local juvenile departments provide local programs that support diversion, restitution, treatment, and other effective programs. The programming, of course, differs between counties depending upon local resources. Upon commitment to the state, youth are held accountable and provided access to treatment through a statewide network of residential and community treatment programs, which includes 658 community beds and more than 100 outpatient treatment providers. State probation and parole officers are responsible for authorizing and coordinating all of these important services. This map just quickly highlights for you the many counties where the state's residential programs are located. Youth are referred to and placed in the programs that best meet their correctional and behavioral treatment needs. And that's an important point to be made, because in the system as it is created today, those youth are often served outside of their county of origin. And this slide represents that. It shows the percent of youth from individual counties and how they are placed throughout Oregon. As you can see, the majority of youth in state custody receive treatment outside their home counties in programs that specialize in meeting their needs, as I just mentioned. And that's an important point. Because we have access to more than 658 residential beds and 100 treatment providers across the state, we are able able to provide not only general programs needed by many youth, such as anger management therapy, but more importantly, we can offer a cost-effective set of specialized programs needed by just a few youth. For example, just 1% of the youth placed in OA's custody have committed arson-related offenses. That's a relatively small number of youth, but the victim impacts of their crimes are serious and damaging, and they clearly need specific treatment. And so with our current system, we are able to offer the right number of beds to serve those youth in a cost-effective manner. The system allows us that flexibility. So, for example, a youth from Klamath County who's committed to us for an arson-related offense might actually be better served at St. Mary's in Washington County, which offers treatment for those fire-setting behaviors, while a youth from Multnomah County who has been committed for a different sort of crime might best be served at the Klamath Youth Ranch. Our analysis, which I discussed in my opening remarks, concludes that the system as it exists today is effective and efficient. While we're always striving to find additional efficiencies, currently as the system works, youth who can be served at home in their local communities are served appropriately by county probation officers. Youth who, for public safety and security reasons, require that out-of-home placement that I talked to earlier, are committed to state custody and have equal access to services throughout the state based on need. This avoids the need for every county to offer every type of programming required: cognitive behavioral therapy, drug and alcohol therapy, sex offender treatment, and fire setting, as I mentioned earlier, just to name a few. Again, as our analysis stated, this proposal, we did not see that it improved public safety, improved outcomes for youth, or saved money. That being said, I really want the record to be clear. If there is a proposal out there that achieves these goals, I want to review it. It's important to note that the current statewide system also involves many partners. If a few large counties pull out of the current coordinated system, changes to this one area will affect the entire system. And that means other counties, the courts, district attorneys, law enforcement agencies, and advocacy groups, of course. So we should, in my opinion, always be working on improving our system, but I don't believe that fragmenting the system is necessarily the right place to start. I'd rather keep working together to strengthen the current system. And I mentioned earlier the Juvenile Justice System Symposium. Last year, we did that, in fact. We led a process to take a unified look at improving Oregon's, in my opinion, already strong juvenile justice system. The venue for that system-wide review was the Oregon Juvenile Justice System Symposium. In collaboration with counties and other partners, we brought together nearly 250 participants from throughout the state to discuss ways to strengthen that system. Participants included county juvenile department directors, district attorneys, judges, law enforcement officers, victims, advocacy groups, and others involved in the state juvenile justice system continuum. These individuals agreed on and have been working diligently on over the last year to the 10 strategies that you see here on this slide to enhance the effectiveness of the state's existing system. So rather than turning away from these strategies and focusing on fragmenting the system, I recommend that all of our partners continue to work on implementing the agreed upon strategies. With that, I thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation, and I certainly welcome any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tomei, why don't you start?
Thank you. I just want to make sure that I understand you when you were talking about funding. So you have access to federal funds. Are you implying that the county programs do not have access to federal funds, or not the same federal funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the point is, I would make a couple of points. One, currently they do not have access to that federal funding. Could they receive that access? That question is unknown at this time. And certainly what I understand about the process in engaging in that application, it is long, and so there at least least would be a delay. The second point that I would make around that funding is training staff and having a system in place to collect that funding is complicated. And so I think what that would create is another inefficiency in the system as you pull a county away from that and they begin collecting those revenues themselves. They're creating another level of training and collection that currently is already being managed by the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Other questions, comments? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So has there been a work group or a discussion group that has included representatives such as yourself and Ask Me and Multnomah County and some of the other counties? I mean, have all of you sat in a room and had any meetings to talk about this situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juan, there have been multiple conversations. We thought that this proposal might be pushed forward during the Juvenile Justice Symposium, where all of those representatives were there, and the proposal was not pushed forward by any of those work groups. So we continue to engage in the conversation with OJDDA, the Juvenile Department Directors Association. We've had multiple conversations with them. In fact, to the point that I think we've been distracted in talking about other things. And further, we've had individual conversations with county juvenile department directors about this proposal.
Follow up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just please, if you can, it makes it a lot easier, certainly for me, to look at a policy objective if the stakeholders have come together and have an understanding about the scope of the problem and the policy objectives and things like that. So if there's any way that you guys can sit in a room and talk to each other, that would really make my thought process on the issue a lot easier. So I want to encourage you to do that, please. And you know, anytime the stakeholders come forward and say, hey, this is what we'd like to do, then the control is in your hands, and it makes it a lot easier. When we're not able to come together on the same page, then those of us sitting over on this side have to make a decision, and there's a winner and a loser. So, thank you.
Colette, how, if this was to happen, the smaller counties, if the funding is diluted from the state, what would their capacity, you think that their capacity would change? And what about the services that are provided by the state? Would they be diminished because of the smaller size of the state program?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Krieger, that's our concern. So my obligation as the director of the Oregon Youth Authority is to maintain a state-run correctional system, and that includes those residential programs that you speak to. The proposal as presented to us, my fear is that if you pull away any one of these counties, and you're talking about five of the largest counties, that the efficiencies that we have in the current state-run system would then dilute the resources that are available to those smaller counties, both at the treatment delivery level and also the residential capacity.
Other questions, comments? Colette, thank you very much for coming
thank
forward.
You very much.
Our last two speakers, invited guests, are Mary Botkin and Molly Rogers. And as they're coming forward, just as a reminder, we do have one other issue that we will be addressing after these two speakers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the members who work at the Oregon Youth Authority and AFSCME Council 75. We represent folks who work both in the county juvenile departments and at the Oregon Youth Authority. And it is important for the committee to understand there seems to be some confusion that we are supporting this proposal. And we need to make it very clear that we are not supporting this proposal, and we're not supporting the movement of counties to take over the Oregon Youth Authority's jurisdiction. But having said that, I think it's also important to understand that we believe that the counties provide a critical and necessary service and with delinquent youth, and that our members who provide those services do a yeoman's job with limited resources and shrinking resources with kids who are severely at risk in sometimes horrific environments in their home life. And You know, we support the work that they do, and we honor that work. At the same time, it is important to understand that we believe that the Oregon Youth Authority provides a very different set of programs with a very different set of youth. And I feel really compelled to sort of walk back a little bit. We have represented both of these groups for many, many years, and Senator, you and I have been around for a long time. We have been here for all of the different models that have been tried. In 1995, the legislature passed House Bill 3438, which set up pilot programs for giving counties authority over the juvenile justice system. And we tried that, and it was really, really a dismal failure. What we found was a fractured system that provided services to youth based on location, geography, and economics. And what we found was that many of our counties just simply could not provide the level of services necessary to very seriously disturbed and risky youthful behavior. And so after a lot of, I think I refer to it as gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands, we created what is now the Oregon Youth Authority under Senate Bill 1. It took an incredible amount of work for us to get there. And our union was not, we were sort of reluctant partners. And our local president, Joe Van Meter at the time, worked for probably a year and a half at developing a bill that we could support that created the Oregon Youth Authority. And even after all of that work, we still felt very reluctant in our support, but we did support it, we supported passage, and we lobbied it to its successful conclusion. The work that the counties do rarely makes headline news. Good kid or bad kid does good simply doesn't make it on the front page of the Oregonian. You know, they are not the ones that we read about. That is not the headline news on the 5 o'clock news at night. What's on the news is a kid who killed another kid. That's what makes the news. And right now, what we need is to take a look at how we bolster what the counties do to circumvent the headline news. And every day, those counties make a difference with kids and someone's child. OIA, when a child is remanded to OIA, we simply must admit that something has gone wrong. And now they're in a system that is different. From the minute that that child is in custody, they are assigned a juvenile parole officer. That juvenile parole officer supervises and works with and becomes an integral part of a treatment team that monitors and works with that child from that day until they complete their treatment and their programming and their sentencing. And so that juvenile parole officer monitors that child all the time they're in custody, when they're in residential treatment, when they're in county or in OIA custody in an OIA facility, all the way through to their field operation, and they monitor that child until that child completes their sentence. And during that period of time, they have the ability to monitor, to moderate their treatment programs and the programs that they will be receiving to address their needs as they change. We think that that is a system that is working and that is a model of progress. It is a progressive model of treatment and deserves to go forward. We have a couple of questions. I mean, our questions are, if the courts remand a child to the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority as envisioned in Senate Bill 1, does the county then have the ability and the authority to supervise that child? Because the courts have made the decision, not somebody else. And so I don't know how you move a child from a court remanded system back to a county that does not have authority to supervise that child. And there are other just mechanical problems with this proposal. The ORS 236605 is the Employee Transfer Act. It is incorporated into Senate Bill 1 as well as a standalone statute. That statute very clearly says that employees have the right to follow their work and that the employer that receives the employee must maintain their current status. That, in this case, includes the fact that all of our juvenile parole officers are non-strikeable, subject to binding arbitration, in police and fire retirement, and the folks who work at the county level are not. The ERB, the Employment Relations Board, has long ruled that mixed units are illegal. So you cannot put a non-strikeable binding arbitration unit inside of a strikeable unit, so you can't combine them. What ERB has ruled consistently is then once you do that, you can do it, but once you do it, then the county unit that those employees moved into is now a non-strikeable binding arbitration unit, must be separated from the rest of the county facility, the county workforce, and handled separately, and it goes into a binding arbitration unit, which is quite frankly okay with us. We handle binding arbitration units all the time. You know, if you want to make all the counties binding juvenile departments binding arbitration units, that's fine, we'll do that. But the question is, does it make sense? And is that really what the counties want? And if it is, then there's a whole series of things we ought to be looking at before we do that. And finally, we need to remember who's at risk here and who we're supposed to be looking for, out for. This is about kids, their families, the community, public safety, and what's best. And reforming kids, this is their last chance. OIA is the last stop before they go into the adult system. Our members and the programs that we administer in the counties and in the state system do a good job of diverting bad behavior and helping kids understand that the choices that they make are going to lead them in one direction or the other. OIA is their last opportunity not to end up in the state criminal justice system. And that really ought to be our goal. The best way to reduce prison populations is to grab these kids when they're making bad choices and show them other alternatives, to give them one more chance before they move into that adult system. It is the best opportunity we have.
Mary, I need you to wrap up.
I'm done.
All righty. Thank you. Molly?
The passion. Good afternoon, Chair Przanski and co-chairs Barker and Krieger. My name is Molly Rogers, and I'm the Director of Youth Services in Wasco County, located in the Dalles. I'm here today before you as the director of Wasco County Department of Youth Services, but also as a member of the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium, fondly known by most as COJAC. It is an entity that has been around for over 25 years, and it has an agreement with the Oregon Youth Authority and that we co-manage youth of the highest risk or who are placed either in the care and custody of the Oregon Youth Authority or who are at imminent risk of becoming in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. My testimony is going to focus today really on the current juvenile justice system that we have and how it's working very successfully within a large geographic region of Oregon. We often hear about the population, and it is correct that we don't have all of the population, but we do have a lot of the land. You've been presented a paper, a concept paper, a proposal, I've heard it called multiple things, that states the current system is redundant and inefficient. And I'm going to challenge a couple of points in that paper to really reflect what the current practice is, at least in the COJAC region. First, The paper correctly states that referrals and recidivism has seen a significant decrease in most of the state. It is arrogant for us to think that we are the only ones that have done that, is the county juvenile departments. I would hope that we are a piece of that, but as we make those kind of claims, then we have to then be willing to accept the other claim, which is when referrals go up or recidivism goes up, then it's our fault, and I don't want to do that. There are many community partners that work towards reducing recidivism and referrals in our communities. And I'll have to admit that Wasco County is not one that has had a reduction in recidivism. That's why I don't want to claim it. That's not true. We haven't. Why, anecdotally, one or two kids make a difference in our statistical numbers? And so when we think about the central and eastern region, one or two youth make a difference. We have all been extremely diligent working together around evidence-based practices, about best practices. OIA and other state agencies, at your direction, have led the charge. They've provided technical assistance to us. They've been key people for us to work with. And that is what I really believe has led to some of the decreases, is our efforts together of focusing dollars and making sure that they're efficiently used. Second, I do not believe that the juvenile justice system is redundant as it currently stands. COJAC, with the Oregon Youth Authority, has entered into a co-management agreement, which I provided for you in written testimony. And we have found a way to co-manage the very high-risk youth that is not repetitive. To the best of my knowledge from state of practice and the juvenile justice information system, the counties that have been presenting the concept paper to you often close their supervision when a youth is committed to the Oregon Youth Authority, either for placement on probation or in a parole status, thus making their argument of redundancy moot. It's not a point. Within the COJAC region, we do not do that. We continue, most of our counties, not all of them, when you've seen one county, you've seen one county, but most of our counties continue with the supervision authority granted to us under the ORS. We remain very active with the youth, the family, and the community to make sure that accountability is focused on, reformation is focused on, and that the public is safe. Just by the very fact that a young person is committed to the Oregon Youth Authority, we at the County Juvenile Department are saying we're out of resources for them. And so one of my colleagues talks about going hand in hand with OIA, and that's what we do. We go hand in hand. In the small counties, we have one parole officer that services five counties. There is no way that a JPPO from the Oregon Youth Authority can provide the level of intensity for those counties that are very, very small. It doesn't mean they're not a key stakeholder, and it doesn't mean they have their role and function, but as counties, we stick right with them. These kids, what we've learned by best practice, and I believe Dr. Ed LaTessa has actually testified before this committee on dosage. And realistically, why wouldn't we want another set of eyes and ears keeping an eye out on these high-risk kids in our community? And that's what the co-management agreement between the COJAC and the Oregon Youth Authority has allowed us to do. The transition is seamless, and the increased level of supervision is what we believe our responsibility is to our community. The third bullet I want to share is one of our county juvenile directors from the COJAC region made the statement that the infrastructure for OIA in his community would be better served if it was able to serve his local youth. The problem with this statement was that he's talking about the infrastructure in his county that serves eight other counties, one of which is mine. When we start tearing at the fabric of the system, you talk about not hurting other counties, and somebody mentioned small counties. When you start tearing at that fabric, what happens if counties don't house an OIA office is that they get left with bits and pieces of workers, support staff, transport assistance, and ultimately access to the appropriate services. We often joke about which part of the JPPO we will get, the nose and toes or the legs and arms, but quite frankly, it's not funny. We don't get the supervision that we need. Once we start tearing at the state system, we're not sure what that leaves us. You saw the map, And there are treatment providers out in the central and eastern area, but what they specialize in may not be what our kids need. In 1995, the Oregon Youth Authority was created based on a task force chaired by then-Attorney General Ted Kulongowski, which met over 52 times in an 11-month period. The task force included over 80 people and 6 special subcommittees. The system was meant to be outcome-driven. And I want to point out that that's very expensive. One of the things I've heard in the hallways or around that we want a task force or a budget note to tell us to sit down together and talk. And my fear of doing that is the expense that task force costs. And they typically have a mission in place, and the task force usually comes out with recommendations to support that mission. And if you talk to practitioners or county juvenile directors after the budget note for the child mental health system, you will hear from them that that particular task force has caused us a lot of havoc and has decreased our access to services for mental health kids. So task forces are expensive, and they're usually very mission-driven. The system created in 1995 was meant to be outcome-driven, and we invested in an amazing data system. The data shows that we have been able to, as a system, maintain and reduce recidivism and our daily bed allocation. We've been through reduction after reduction, and our system has risen to meet those reductions and keep our public safe.
Molly, I'm going to need you to wrap
up. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up for you. The new proposal takes a lot of time. This proposal has taken a lot of time. And what I would encourage the group to do, similar to what Representative Juan said earlier, is continue the conversation that we did at the symposium. To continue talking, there are ways to co-manage together rather than tearing our system apart. And I will entertain any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for either of the panelists? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. I do want to put on the record, I did receive a call from Joe Schaefer, who represents SEIU. They also had opposition. I told him, or I left a message for him, because of our timing, we would not be able to hear from him, but I did want to put something on the record on their behalf. Our last item that we have today is a review on the Oregon State Bar's policy in addressing complaints regarding an attorney's failure to adequately represent clients based on the client's race, ethnic origin, religion, gender, or gender preferences. This has been an issue that we've had colleagues both on the House and on the Senate side over the last two or three sessions. I made a commitment that we would have one more opportunity to have this heard. And so at this time, I am going to ask for Susan. I know that you have three individuals here, Hunter Merrick, I believe, Sylvia Stevens, and Marianne Hyland. If you all three would come up, there was notice given to Cal Henry, who has been a proponent of having the current rules that are the state bar's policy to be codified into statute, and I did not see him or others who've asked for this here today, but we will go ahead and take some time to put your statements on the record, and then...
Can I ask a quick question? From whom did we get this?
It's you, Bill.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, a couple of senators asked me if there were any testimony from the counties, and they did not bring any. The four counties are in favor of this proposal. They did not bring any written testimony like this with us. Scott Taylor, about a week ago, sent me something by email, which I went upstairs and copied. It's the only thing I have on this. I wasn't in the impression that it was necessary for distribution, but it does at least give an outline of what their proposal is.
Thank you.
I have to admit that's one of the problems we're having. We have a system that's both electronic and paper. When I get something now, I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to forward it to the members or if it's my own edification. So I assume when someone comes to testify and they're making a point, they will still bring paper copies.
All right. Thank you. Who'd like to start off?
Mr. Chair, Brzezinski, my name's Hunter Emmerich, and co-chairs Barker and Mr. Krieger. I'm a local attorney here in Salem. My offices are just down the street. I'm a new member of the Board of Governors for the Oregon State Bar, and also a new chair for the Public Affairs Committee, which is why I am here before you to assist in the response to this committee's inquiry. I'm going to be brief. My written testimony has been handed out by Mr. Taylor there. I have with me Ms. Sylvia Stevens. She is the executive director from the Oregon State Bar. And Ms. Marianne Hyland, she is in charge of our diversity program for the Oregon State Bar. I'm going to be a little bit of the cheerleader here, kind of an oversized cheerleader maybe, but a short one anyway. Ms. Stevens is going to address the specific questions that you raised in your inquiry about this important issue. And Ms. Hyland, with the time permitted, will also brief you on what's going on with the bar in terms of our diversity and inclusion efforts statewide. So for the cheerleading part of the deal, I'm here before you as a proud Oregon attorney. I think we have a very wonderful state bar. As you probably know, it's all funded by Oregon lawyers and by the services that the bar provides to Oregon lawyers and also to members of our community. It doesn't take any tax money. What our bar does, it is incredibly unique, really, is it's one of the only bars that has an open disciplinary system. Any member of the public can get into a person's disciplinary history from the start of the complaint, and that's important for folks in terms of knowing who they're dealing with as a professional. Also, what our bar does, which is extremely unique, is that we require all Oregon lawyers to have malpractice insurance. There are very few states in the union that do that, and in fact, the bar is so committed that it has its own malpractice insurance company, essentially the professional liability fund, that provides up to $300,000 for every Oregon lawyer. And it is amazing to me that, frankly, other states don't have a program that requires this. Finally, we have a tremendous campaign for equal justice, and it's funded primarily by Oregon lawyers' donations, and they are substantial, and the Oregon Bar really supports equal access to justice. The rest of my comments are in the materials and are not directly responsive to the questions, so I'll turn it over to Ms. Stevens so that she can address the questions that you raised.
Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, thank you. As you know, I'm Sylvia Stevens, the Executive Director of the Oregon State Bar. I've been with the bar for 19 years, and I think I'm as familiar as anybody with the work that we've done during the time I've been there, and a few years before that, relating to racial and ethnic bias in the judicial system. I'm here today to answer the specific questions that were posed to us. The first question is, do we get complaints about inadequate representation because of the racial or ethnic background of the client? And as a matter of fact, we get very few. And we don't track them as such, but I have answered thousands of phone calls in my tenure at the bar, and I know both that way and looking at the files that we have that we don't get them. When we do get a complaint, it's usually where a racial or ethnic bias is a piece of it, it's part of a larger complaint about the overall quality of the services the client received from their lawyer. And fortunately or unfortunately, most of these complaints that we get are from inmates who have been represented by public defenders. We've not found most of them to have merit. But we also don't have jurisdiction over quality of service issues. The rules of professional conduct that we manage and for which we investigate and prosecute lawyers don't address quality of service beyond the basic obligation to provide competent representation to every client. When there are legitimate concerns about a lawyer's competency, the reason for that incompetent representation is not relevant to us. We look to see whether that lawyer provided the basic level of competent representation and go from there, and that is part of the reason we don't track the reason, the allegation of why the representation was incompetent. The rules of professional conduct, like the ABA model rules that they are largely patterned after, don't directly address racial and ethnic bias, prejudice, discrimination. In the ABA rules, they're in comment, which is a separate part of the rules that are meant to flesh out the actual rules themselves. We don't have comment in Oregon. Recently, however, we've decided to follow the lead of a number of other states and make what is implicit in some of the existing rules explicit. And we are in the process of promulgating, if that's the right word, a rule that would make it misconduct for lawyers to manifest bias or prejudice in the course of representing a client. It's very early days yet. There's a rough draft that's going to our Board of Governors tomorrow. The rule has not yet been sent out to the membership for comment, and it will ultimately have to be approved by our members and by the Supreme Court. And I'm not going to predict what, you know, how that process is going to go, but I'm reasonably optimistic, cautiously optimistic, that we will, by this time next year, or close to it, have such a rule in place. The other question we had, one of the questions, is how do we train lawyers about diversity and those issues? Since April of 2001, so it's more than 10 years now, all Oregon lawyers have been required to have continuing legal education on racial and ethnic bias issues as they affect the judicial system. It's currently called an Access to Justice credit. It's had several names in its 10-year life. But the focus of the courses that are accredited is that they must address the effects of bias and prejudice in the justice system. Every lawyer has to complete three Access to Justice credits in alternate three-year reporting periods. So it's three credits in 6 years. In the 10 years that this requirement has been in place, we have accredited more than 3,500 programs, at least a third of which are focused on racial and ethnic bias. The others address some of the other types of bias, gender, poverty, other things that are incorporated in that rule. What have we done to increase diversity in the profession? I'm going to leave most of that to my colleague, Marianne Hyland, but I will say that we're a recognized leader in this area because we established what we then called and still do call an affirmative action program in 1974. And this was a member-driven initiative through which both the leadership of the bar and the members of the bar have invested many thousands of dollars and many thousands of hours and lots of energy developing and implementing programs and projects to recruit and retain a more diverse bar and bench. And I think we've been successful in the efforts we've made. We have much more work to do, and Marianne can talk more about that. The last question you asked was about mentoring. There have been a variety of mentoring programs available for lawyers, law students as well, for several years. Most of them are either sponsored by law schools or by local bar associations or specialty bars. And our very own Affirmative Action Program has a judicial mentorship program where we pair up law students with judges in the communities, which gives them a nice way to learn about being a lawyer and how the system works, and gives them a nice introduction. This year, the bar began a mandatory mentoring program for all new lawyers. It was a joint venture of the Supreme Court and the bar and the Joint Bench Bar Professionalism Commission. Under the program, every lawyer who's admitted after February of 2011, who has not practiced somewhere else for a couple of years, is going to be paired up with an experienced Oregon practitioner, and over the course of 15 to 18 months, depending on when they're admitted to practice, they must complete a required curriculum of activities, some of which do. One component is a discussion and talk, kind of learning about bias in the profession and how it affects the practice of law. So that is our mentoring effort, and it's underway and seems to be getting a good start.
Thank you.
Chair Prozanski, co-chairs Barker and Krieger. My name is Marianne Hyland. I'm the Director of Diversity and Inclusion for the Oregon State Bar. I'm fairly new in my role. I've been in the position with the bar since June of this year, but I have a long history and familiarity with the bar's programs. I graduated from law school from the University of Oregon in 1991, and at that point in time, we were not very diverse in our membership of the bar. I'm pleased to report that since 1997, we've increased in the number of minority attorneys who have self-identified in our membership from by 113%. So from 412 to 881 lawyers currently today who identify themselves as minorities. So back in 1991, when I was practicing, there were only two organizations dedicated to diverse lawyers. One was the Oregon Women Lawyers, dedicated to advocating for women in the law, and the other was the Association of Oregon Black Lawyers. Today, we have a total of six specialty bars dedicated to diverse constituents, including the Oregon Minority Lawyers, the Oregon Asian Pacific Bar Association, the Hispanic Bar Association, the OGALA, Oregon Gay and Lesbian Law Alliance, etc. So I think one of the things that's apparent is that the increasing numbers of diverse lawyers in this state has led to a proliferation of specialty bars. And at the Oregon State Bar, we partner with these specialty bars to identify strategies and tactics for taking it to the next level. We recognize that diversity and inclusion is something that does not happen overnight, and it takes steady work, working with a diverse group of constituents and partners. And so we're very pleased to be able to partner with the specialty bars. Also, in 2002, we established a diversity section of the bar, which is another partner that we rely on to help us advance our initiatives. As mentioned previously, the bar has had a longstanding affirmative action program founded in 1974. We have had many programs over the years that have been quite successful, targeted toward recruitment and retention of diverse law students in the state of Oregon. Programs such as scholarship programs, bar grant programs, programs dedicated to mentoring and networking in the community. So I'm pleased to be with the bar now, and I'm looking very forward to working with Sylvia and Hunter and the rest of the Board of Governors and the other leaders of the bar and our sections and specialty bars to advance our initiatives, including developing a diversity strategic plan and figuring out how to really engage our entire community to continue to address the issues identified in the task force and to forge new ideas and new partnerships. So thank you very much for having us today, and I guess I'll open it up to questions at this point in time.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions? Co-Chair Krieger.
I'm trying to think of the date. I think it was October 15th of 2009. I was in Austin, Texas with Chief Justice Judge Brewer on the Chief Justice's Symposium on Dependency of Children. And the number one thing, not only at that symposium, but all those that attended identified, was the lack of competent legal representation in that particular field of dependency. And of course, Judge Waters worked on that with people of color in this state. And I don't know if we are going to come to a conclusion or something that we need to do legislatively or that the bar is working on to make sure that those people do get proper representation. Can you comment on that at all?
Senator Przanski and Chairs Barker and Krieger, I guess my comment would be, at the bar we take continuing education and competent representation very seriously. And I know that most lawyers in Oregon who care about what they do really make an effort to become educated in the areas in which they practice. Whether we have enough good practitioners in that area, I can't speak to because I don't know the details. It's not an area that I'm horribly familiar with, unfortunately. I do know one of the problems is that most of those in programs where the lawyers are being funded by the state for indigent clients,
yes,
they are underpaid and overworked.
Yep.
And it's very difficult for them to provide the kind of service that a lawyer who's being paid by the hour could give to a client. It's just not humanly possible for them. So I think that's part of the problem. And I hate to think that the answer to everything is to throw money at it, but this is one area where throwing money at it would help.
So you want to follow? I know Susan does want to say something, but...
Excuse me, Susan Gravey, Public Affairs Director for the State Bar. Co-chairs Senator Przanski, Representative Krieger, in response to your question, I'd also add that the bar has a task force that's working on developing best practice standards for juvenile dependency delinquency cases right now, and we hope to have results for that probably not before the February session, but sometime before June.
Just a comment, I'm trying to think of the year 2000. 5, 6, 7, I can't recall, we actually were able to get a few more dollars because we actually wanted to target dependency and up that, but it kind of got put across the board rather than target.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't see how you can pay a court-appointed attorney $45 an hour and the attorney is paying $85 an hour tomorrow for the plumber. So in my own mind, it's the lack of proper compensation. Too many cases. They can't possibly handle 200, 300 cases.
and we need to not allow them to have that many cases, and then the proper representation comes in when they have enough dollars coming in to help do the staff people to do investigations and get the information. Half of those people's representation takes place out in the hallway 15 minutes before they walk into the courtroom. That's not adequate representation. And those of us that have been on the dependency work groups, Representative Tomei, Schlaffer, myself, Senator Cruz, we see this routinely. And so I just want to encourage the State Bar. I know that having had conversations with Susan, that they are working that way. It was badly needed. It's appreciated by us that you are working in that direction.
Any other questions or comments? Well, knowing that we have to go to the floor on the Senate side, the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary is adjourned for today, and thank everyone for participating.
And the House is also adjourned today. Thank you.